From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Later today, the jury should begin deliberating in the case of former BART police officer Johannes Messerli, charged in the shooting death of Oscar Grant. Closing arguments got underway yesterday and are scheduled to wrap up by this afternoon. In the hour ahead, legal analyst Peter Keene will weigh in on what the jury now has to resolve. And we'll also hear from both police as well as community leaders and activists about how the city of Oakland will respond to whatever the verdict turns out to be. It's the latest on the Messerli case, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Soon it will be up to the jury, as final arguments wind down today in the case of former BART police officer Johannes Messerli, charged in the shooting death of Oscar Grant, New Year's morning, January 9. The jury will weigh a number of possible outcomes, ranging from second-degree murder to voluntary manslaughter to involuntary manslaughter to not guilty of all charges. That Messerli killed Oscar Grant is not in doubt. But was it an accident, as the defense claimed, or is Messerli guilty of some other crime, either by way of intent or negligence? We're going to try to sort out what the charges are this morning and how the jury will go about weighing that task. But there is another aspect to this trial, and that's how the city of Oakland will respond to the verdict, regardless of what it is. And we want to start with that part of the story. So joining us first is Anthony Bass, chief of the Oakland Police Department. Chief Bass, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so very much. Thank you for having me.
We've been reading a lot and seeing a lot on the nightly news over the last few days about the prospects of how Oakland will react depending on what the verdict is. Are you concerned at all about there being a sort of self-fulfilling nature of that, that because we're talking so much about what happened in January of 2009 when the incident happened, that we're sort of setting ourselves up for that to happen again?
Yeah, it's. I'm concerned about the images that we are portraying to the public, and much like what I lived through in 1992 with the Rodney King incident that took place in Southern California, here in January of 2009 and now we're showing images of officers with batons and riot gear practicing, and also images that have taken place, and I've tried to get out to the media and the public that we're not picking up that type of information or intelligence. And just today, I'm just starting to see that we're looking at rallies and people are trying to hold peaceful rallies.
We're going to hear a little bit from some of those community leaders later in the program. But tell me more about what you're hearing. Do you have sources out there who are giving you some sense of what might happen pending what the verdict is?
The community's been pretty quiet. I think a lot of people are watching. There's not been a lot of information. The police department and myself, we've held a number of meetings with the community. I've had a number of pastors and community leaders sharing with them a great deal of information, asking for their assistance on the front end, making sure we take care of our community. In January, when I went back to look at the statistics from that incident, 75% of the people arrested were not residents of Oakland. They were people from outside. And what I'm picking up from Oakland residents is that we live here. We work here, we play here, and we have to exist here after this, and we don't want our city injured or destroyed or dysfunctional activity here.
Do you have any sense, though, about whether or not, I mean, how can you know whether or not out-of-towners will return again?
You don't know, and all you can do is prepare, and what has been shown on TV is me giving directions towards my staff to make sure that we prepare. We've been working on this, tabletoping it. Exercising with other units, not that we want to perpetuate an issue or a situation, because we don't, and we're not looking to be the epicenter, and we're going to facilitate everyone's First Amendment rights, and we're not going to overreact, but that comes from the practice, and that's all you can do. You can prepare, you can practice, you can reach out to your community, you can be transparent and ask for assistance and help, and the first line of keeping things in line is going to be our community.
Well, let's talk for a moment about what you are preparing and training to do, both from the police side and what you think residents can also do in this sort of situation. From the police side first, when you talk about training and preparing, what is it that you're exactly getting ready to contend with?
Well, it's for any other crisis, whether you have a major hurricane or earthquake, a fire, a flood. The model's all the same. You have to prepare to communicate. You have to prepare to get resources from point A to point B. You have to make sure that officers are well disciplined and practiced. If they're practiced, they tend to be very well disciplined. They don't overreact. They understand what's coming towards them. To give out directions that they understand to facilitate. Our number one issue here is to facilitate the right to free speech and to protest, and to make sure that is understood.
And what advice would you have, Chief Bass, for the residents of Oakland and the business proprietors there as well, both downtown, perhaps near the Fruitvale BART station? What are you recommending that people do to be vigilant, to be prepared?
I think everyone just needs to take a very deep breath. With all, like we started this conversation, everyone is watching the TVs, and it's just kind of tightening everyone up. And what I want people to know is to take a deep breath. We are prepared for this. We are ready for this. We've been working on it for a while. I don't want people to run scared or think that there's issues. You take common sense precautions. Know in the day if we're going to have protests and people are going to be out in the streets marching, that you may have ingress egress issues. You may have trouble getting in and out because you have traffic related issues. Make sure or talk to your neighbors about this, and make sure that we take care of our community. And I think it'll all work out on the opposite side.
Seems like you're saying take common sense measures. Watch where you park your car, for example, or move your trash bins, but not necessarily board up your windows if you're a downtown business owner?
I think those are all decisions that an individual person has to make. The downtown owners had a number of several stores were damaged last year. Windows were broken out. Those things were repaired, and insurance companies covered some of those things. We will not allow any residents or outside visitors to our city to destroy the city. So we will respond to those things immediately. We are planning for those things. But I think the business owners have to make their decisions based on their perception and from where they see their vantage point.
Chief Anthony Bass, Chief of the Oakland Police Department. Chief Bass, thanks for joining us. Good luck in the days ahead.
Thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
Chief Anthony Bass joining us this morning, starting out. And we'll return to this subject a bit later in the program. We're going to talk with community leaders and activists about how Oakland can contend with whatever may happen in the days ahead. But we want to focus our attention now on the trial itself, on the charges that the jury is now going to have to sort its way through. And joining us to provide some analysis of that is Peter Keene. He's Dean Emeritus and Professor of Law at the Golden Gate University Law School, also a former member of the San Francisco Police Commission. Peter Keene, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's begin by talking about what the jury is now going to consider. They should begin their deliberations in just a few hours. First off, the judge took one charge off the table before final arguments even began and said there's just not enough evidence to consider a first-degree murder charge. Did allow both a second-degree murder possibility as well as the manslaughter charges. What do you make of the judge's decision in that regard?
That was a proper decision. It's a judgment call that a judge has, a legal judgment call that a judge must make regarding whether or not there's sufficient evidence upon which a reasonable jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt that it was first-degree murder. That is, that the evidence showed that it was premeditation and deliberation, and there would be no reasonable doubt about that. And he looked at it and he said, we don't have any evidence of premeditation or deliberation, mainly because of the speed with which it was done. Therefore, since there is no evidence on that issue, or not any evidence that a reasonable jury could find that it existed, that first-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt, I am under a legal obligation not to allow them to deliberate on that. So that's a proper judgment call that a judge could make. One could take a second guess it, but it's well within the guidelines for a judge, and may have actually been legally required.
Now, the defense wanted, the defense in this case, of course, is that which is defending the actions of Johannes Messerli. The defense wanted to take manslaughter off the table and just have the jury look at whether or not this was murder or not. Why would the defense want to take manslaughter off the table? Walk us through the thinking there on the defense part.
That's a very easy tactical one to see. Essentially, actually, the defense really didn't even want the judge to take away first-degree murder. What the defense wanted was the jury to have two simple options. First-degree murder, that is malice, premeditation, deliberation, all the burdens upon the prosecution to prove that, or acquittal, one or the other. Now, in that situation, you can see the defense's strategy there, that that's really asking a lot of the jury, and there's a good likelihood that no reasonable jury is going to go there. So what other alternative do they have? Acquittal. Walk them. So that was a very explainable tactic that defense attorneys make quite often in cases like that. Give the jury something that you fairly well know the jury can't possibly do that. And then the other only alternative is free the client. So that's understandable.
So we now have on the table a broader menu of possibilities, which in a sense, I suppose, makes the jury's task more complex. Walk us through, Peter, first of all, the difference between second-degree murder and the manslaughter charges, because there are two kinds of manslaughter. So walk us through.
I think the easiest way to do it, rather than go through the whole menu, which we'd get lost in, is to look first in terms of what it is that the prosecution is telling the jury that they should find and what it is that the defense is telling the jury they should find. Prosecution is saying, quite directly, you should find him guilty of second-degree murder. That means that the prosecution is saying the evidence showed that he intended to unlawfully kill Oscar Grant, that he pulled out his gun and shot him, intending to kill him, and that was unlawful. There was no lawful reason to do it. On the other side, you have the defense saying, no, he committed a lawful act, the lawful act being he believed Grant was resisting and he was going to tase him, and that was lawful and reasonable under the circumstances. And he made a mistake, not a criminally negligent mistake, but just he made a mistake as to where the gun and the taser were, but he engaged in a lawful, perhaps negligent, but not criminally negligent, act that killed Oscar Grant. If the jury believes that, then the jury must acquit. Now, in between, you've got those things, that menu that we've talked about, but rather than getting lost in them, there's a couple of things I think we can take right off the table. In terms of looking at whether the jury does take them off the table, something else again, because they might compromise and go to one, even though it doesn't seem to apply based on the evidence. For voluntary manslaughter, there are two things that can be shown. It has to be heat of passion. Well, there doesn't seem to – no one's arguing here that there was any kind of heat of passion in regard to Messerly. Everything was done rather quickly. There was adrenaline that was going on, but it's not the kind of thing for heat of passion type of crime. And the other thing is that he acted in terms of some sort of imperfect self-defense. Those are the two things that would form voluntary manslaughter. And imperfect self-defense would be he believed he had to kill him. He was wrong, but he believed that he had to use lethal force in order to keep himself from suffering some sort of bodily injury. His own testimony was that, no, that's not what I was doing. I was just trying to tase him. I didn't believe I had to kill him, so therefore I wasn't reaching for my gun. So in terms of the evidence itself, or even what Messerly is saying, voluntary manslaughter would seem to be out. So if you were to look at the menu, the menu based upon the evidence would either be second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, or acquittal.
So it sounds like one of the key points here is this question of understanding what Johannes Messerly's intent was. Let's walk through some of what both the defense and the prosecution is claiming about what he says. One of the defense is saying that not only did he intend to use his taser, he said out loud, I'm going to tase him. The prosecution's response to that is, well, if that was his intent, how come he hasn't said so? He didn't talk about it afterwards. This never came up. So it calls that into question. How do you read how that argument went about whether or not it's believable that he wanted to use his taser?
Well, I think there are two main aspects of evidence that are most damaging regarding Grant, and one is Grant's. And regarding Messerly, Messerly has said, "Well, I couldn't get his right arm around in order to handcuff it. So therefore, I had to tase him, and he was doing something with his right arm under his body, and I thought that might have been something, maybe looking for a weapon. So therefore, I had to tase him, couldn't get. But then the video shows that at the time Messerly stands up and pulls out the gun and shoots, Grant's right arm is held down against his back by Peroni,
who also
the other officer, who also has his knee on Grant's head. So that sort of physically contradicts what Messerly said. The other thing was, which you mentioned, is that Messerly did not say, "Oh my God, I wanted to reach for the taser and I reached for the gun." Until some time after the shooting, he said to Peroni, the other officer, his best friend, "I thought he was going for a gun." They're sort of implicitly in that saying, "Therefore, I took out my gun and shot him." And it wasn't until some time after that that we have any documentation of him saying to someone else, it's actually a couple of days later, that "I mistook the taser for the gun." Those are the things that damn him, I think, a lot. In addition to that, just the weight of the gun, the differences between the taser and the gun.
Well, let's drill down on that a bit. One of the things that the prosecution has brought up is that it's difficult to make that mistake. A gun weighs a lot more than the taser. There's a different procedure in terms of taking it out of the holster. Messerly also had his taser on a different side of his body, to the left of his belt buckle, as opposed to his pistol side, which was on the right. What is that, again, how is a jury to sort through that? It sounds like you're suggesting, Peter, that there's a fair amount on the prosecution side of that question.
Oh, I think there is. I think you have to look at it in terms of just dispassionately looking at the evidence and seeing what's there. On that issue, in terms of mistaking the taser for the gun, the prosecution's got a fair amount going for it. One of the biggest things is just the weight of the taser as opposed to the gun. The taser, the feel of a taser in your hand, it feels more like a water gun as opposed to a pistol, which is very heavy, about 2.5 pounds. And so that's something that it's very apparent from the weight. The other thing is that in regard to getting the taser out of the holster and regard to getting the gun out, there's very different things that you have to do with straps that are on the particular gun or holster and straps that are on the taser holster, and then also the safety that must be released. So there's a whole set of different procedures. It's not just, you know, reaching for a glass of water and that's next to a glass of Coca-Cola and getting the Coca-Cola by mistake and taking a drink of that. It's much more complex. Not to say that, you know, that Messerly is lying or anything like that. I'm not making that kind of judgment. But I'm saying in terms of the factual situation, Messerly's got a lot to contend with just by saying, "Well, I mistook the taser for the gun."
This gets at, in part, the question of training, which was discussed a lot at the trial. There are those who argue on the defense side that Messerly was poorly trained, that BART police officers just weren't poorly trained. And what you saw here, in fact, was what they sometimes call taser confusion, and that's even discussed in training. But he just wasn't well enough trained. What interests me in part, Peter Keene, is that the training issue was something that both sides tried to argue. On the defense, it was he was poorly trained, he didn't know what he was doing, and he made a mistake. On the prosecution side, it seems like the argument won. He was poorly trained, and therefore he was kind of out of control, didn't know, you know, he wasn't an adept officer, and so he acted in the way he did. How do you read that whole question of training?
I think you have to read that the jury is going to say exactly what you just did when they look at it and say, okay, one group of experts is telling us one thing, one group of experts is telling us the other. It's a wash. And they'll just toss it aside, as they often do, where they have competing experts, and they say, okay, what else do we have? Rather than trying to determine this battle of experts, there's no question that the training was poor. There are other things that were said about the training as the prosecution made the point, the training emphasized various things that made it unlikely that he would have this kind of confusion between the taser and the gun. So essentially, I think the jury is going to look at that and say, that doesn't do much for us. Let's toss it aside, see what else is there.
One of the things that you said would be crucial in this trial, speaking of what else is there, was whether or not Messerly would take the stand. When we did this, when we did a sort of preview of the trial a number of weeks ago, you said that that was going to be crucial and that you felt he had to take the stand. It wasn't entirely clear until right towards the end of the trial that he indeed would, but he did. And some of the accounts, firsthand accounts of reporters at the trial, have said that his testimony sort of washed away a lot else, that both sides had prepared all of this evidence, but it really is going to come down to how Messerly did on the stand. How did he do?
Oh, yeah. I think he did very well from all accounts. He was a good witness. You know, he's a presentable young man. He doesn't have any kind of a background of any kinds of problems, as opposed to that other officer, Peroni, who was with him. If he was sort of a Dirty Harry type cop, if it had been Peroni rather than Messerly, then Peroni would have had a tougher time. But he presented himself quite well. He held up quite well. And you're correct. I think anyone who's ever done any kind of criminal defense work knew that Messerly was going to take the stand. He had to, for all the posturing of the defense attorney. Well, we may not put him on. This is a case where the defendant had to testify. The whole thing in terms of any defense was based upon what was going on in the defendant's mind. Who's the only one who can tell us what was going on in the defendant's mind? The defendant. So he got up and took the stand. Now, what that does, that's a very interesting dynamic in a criminal case, because we all know that no one can be found guilty in a criminal case unless the prosecution proves the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And the jury takes that seriously. But something changes when the defendant takes the stand. When the defendant takes the stand and gives his version, even though the judge will still instruct on reasonable doubt, even though the jury will have it in their mind, all of a sudden the burden of the changes, and has the prosecution proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt? The jury resolves it by one simple thing. Do we believe Messerly? Do we believe the defendant? And that becomes almost like a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is 51%, rather than the high standard. That's why most times you don't want a defendant to testify in a criminal case. But here he had to do it, pulled it off pretty well. Question is, do they believe him or don't they believe him?
Well, let's spend a moment on that, and then we're going to have to take a short break, because the other thing that you said when we previewed the trial a few weeks ago is that jury selection would be absolutely critical. The jury consists of, just in terms of the racial component of the jury, 7 whites, 4 Latinos, and 1 individual who declined to state his race on the jury questionnaire. That can't have been what the prosecution was necessarily hoping for, to have no African Americans on this jury. What have you read into who this jury is?
This jury is basically a middle class white jury, which is going to be a pro-Messerly jury. Because as opposed to if you had African-Americans or minorities on the jury, that group of people would have frames of reference in regard to police officers using abusive force on members of their community. For the most part, members of the majority white community, we don't have that type of frame of reference. And so we come at something like this with the idea, well, you know, if a cop is doing something, there's probably a good reason for a cop to do it. Whereas opposed to minority people, they would say, well, you know, maybe not. You know, we've seen things. So the prosecution started out behind in regard to that. I think the main importance, though, of the complexion of this jury is not so much, well, it'll certainly be in terms of the verdict that they rendered, but in the credibility of the verdict, particularly if there is an acquittal or there's a verdict that's considered too lenient.
Peter Keene, professor of law at Golden Gate University Law School, joining us this hour to talk about the Johannes Messerly trial. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to talk about what some of the aspects of the verdict may be and how that may impact the city of Oakland. We're going to hear from 2 community leaders on that point, and also take your questions, too, about both the case, what your questions are about the legal components of that case, and what your concerns about how Oakland will fare. We'll take those calls when we return. Here's the number, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the trial of Johannes Messerly, now winding up. The jury will get the case in just a few hours and begin their deliberations. We want to welcome your calls. If you have questions for our legal analyst, Peter Keene, about the nature of the trial, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Go ahead and put in your calls on that score, and we'll get to them in just a moment. But first, we want to get a little bit more on the potential potential community reaction. And joining us to do that are two individuals who have been thinking a lot about how the community may respond. Tony Coleman is a community organizer. He's with OneFam.org, which is part of the coalition group New Year's Movement for Justice for Oscar Grant. He's helping to organize a rally in downtown Oakland on the day of the verdict. Mr. Coleman, thanks for being with us.
How you doing?
Good, thank you. And Scott Peterson joins us as well. He's public policy director for the Oakland Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Peterson, thanks for being with us too.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Tony Coleman, first, the rally that you're organizing is at 14th and Broadway, downtown Oakland, and you've made a couple of interesting choices about that. You've said that the key focus here is to let people talk. It's a kind of open mic situation, not so much a march, but an opportunity for people to really voice their feelings about this trial, this verdict, whatever it turns out to be. Why did you decide on that sort of focus for the rally?
Well, we wanted to make sure that we had a space for young folks and for people in general to be able to express themselves. I think that was kind of like part of the problem last time was folks just didn't have, you know, enough resources to be able to express themselves and just feel like they're not being heard. And the reason why we chose 14th and Broadway is because that's where folks naturally congregate anyway. And so it was best just to be there with a plan opposed to not. And we're not going to be marching this time, you know, because last time the march got pretty huge and we kind of lost a little, you know, we lost control. And, you know, we want to just kind of like stay in one area and be able to provide that space. And so folks, young people can have that opportunity. Other folks can, from members of the community, can have opportunity to speak and share. Members of the legal community, all members of the community can share, what are some of the next steps, if possible, if the verdict comes out in favorable of the cop. You know, we want to, you know, have, because there was a, just like in the Rodney King verdict, there was a next step. You know, there was, you know, the feds, the Department of Justice. There were other things. So we would like to know what these things are. And as a community, we would like to, you know, come together and collectively figure out what those things are.
Tony Coleman, community organizer with OneFam.org, organizing the rally that will take place whenever the verdict actually comes down. Scott Peterson is joining us as well. He's public policy director for the Oakland Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Peterson, it sounds from what Mr. Coleman is saying and what Chief Batt said earlier that a lot of thought is being given to how to organize a community response that's vocal, that gives people a chance to weigh in one way or the other, regardless of what the verdict is. But a lot of thought is being given to not having some of the events that happened in January of 2009. I know one thing the Chamber is doing is that you've also created this Oscar Grant Memorial Fund. Is that part of an effort also to try to steer community reaction in a particular direction?
Well, I think it's absolutely important that that every effort be made to, as you say, steer the community in a peaceful direction. The Chamber certainly supports everyone's right to free speech, and we welcome the efforts by Mr. Coleman and the coalition of organizations that he's working with to allow people to have an opportunity to express themselves, to try and heal from this process, because we know that, you know, that's going to take some time. But we also see that what's happening in Oakland really captures our community at its best. And we need to focus on that, and we need to encourage everyone to do that, because it's a choice for Oakland. Do we want to show the world, which has its eyes on us now with this trial, that, you know, we can actually get through this, that Oakland can allow people to express themselves peacefully and demonstrate that the diverse community that Oakland is a welcoming place for all viewpoints. And so we're glad to see that the community groups are coming together, that the city is working in collaboration with them. The city's also reaching out to business organizations and merchant associations to make sure that they're prepared in case things don't go well, in case some splinter factions that are, you know, have a mind for violence and for destruction, you know, will be able to be contained, and that anyone who wants to avoid violence can do so.
Scott Peterson of the Oakland Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, along with Tony Coleman of OneFam.org, joining us to talk about how the city of Oakland can respond whenever the verdict comes down. Peter Keene is here, too, playing the role of legal analyst for us this morning. He is Dean Emeritus and Professor of Law at Golden Gate University Law School. We welcome your comments, too. Whether it's about the community situation in Oakland or legal questions, we'd like to hear both of your concerns this morning. Here is the number, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Mr. Coleman of onefam.org and Scott Peterson of the Chamber of Commerce, if you can both stay with us, that would be great while we take a couple of calls. Joining us first, Hugh in Oakland. Hugh, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. First, I wanted to thank the organizers that you have and the community groups that are coming together to give a voice to the different opinions and feelings in our diverse community. Secondly, I wanted to express concerns over coverage by some members of the media about both the trial and the potential results for Oakland. Most of the newspapers and the blogs have, Oakland blogs, have actually done a pretty good job of talking about what the community groups are doing, having clips from Kamala Harris and others. But I'm concerned about mostly the traditional electronic media, especially the quote-unquote local news. Last year, CBS 5 did extensive interviews with the most radical elements of the demonstrators, especially Revolution Books, who they interviewed repeatedly. Many of the local news broadcasts are starting off with clips of both the riots and rehashes of the video.
Hugh, let me hold you there. Yeah, no, I get your concern. It's a very important point, and thank you for offering it up this morning. Tony Coleman, respond to that, if you will, in terms of how you want to have your organization represented, and the concern that Hugh is raising, that Chief Batts also raised earlier, about groups, especially from out of town, sort of taking over and dominating the airwaves.
Well, I would like to say this, is that it's been a lot of hysteria, and it's created a lot of concern with a lot of community, a lot of us that's working in the community, because, you know, it's already the cops, you know, get overzealous, and we're really fearful of cops overreacting. So there's been a lot of attention paid to, and it's most of the blame is placed on the people opposed to the cops who have been out here killing our kids. And when they be out, and when they're talking about outside agitators, for most part, the outside agitators are the cops who don't live in our communities, and their kids don't go to school in our communities. And so we will want the blame to be fairly placed amongst the both, because it seems like it just mostly the concern has been about the fringe groups and all that, and most of all the concern was about property damage. And I care about Oakland, and I care about, and I'm a business owner, and I care about the businesses, and I don't want none of them to suffer. And that's why we wanted to step out there and lead by example and be able to provide an alternative so folks that feel that they have to do that, that other folks that don't want to do that can come and do what we're doing. But we still don't need to keep putting all this energy into what the small few folks that was doing property damage. And then all these videos that's coming out that's showing violence is not justice and all that, and it was mostly property damage. It wasn't like people were out in the streets cutting each other, killing each other. I mean, the mayor was out amongst the people, for Christ's sakes, walking up and down the streets. Mayor Dellums. I mean, of course there were folks running around and but taking advantage of that opportunity to bust windows and try to get their extreme points of view out. But for the most part, it was people out in the streets. And downtown is like Town Square. When something happens in Oakland, most folks congregate down here.
Let me hold you there, Mr. Coleman. Thank you for offering that point of view. I know you have to leave us. Good luck with your rally and its intended purpose, which I know is to give voice to the concerns that you were just raising and to keep it peaceful, both for the benefit of those participating, but also for the business owners in downtown Oakland. I know you have to leave us, but thanks for offering your point of view. Let's hear next from Louise in Daly City. Louise, go ahead, please.
Hi there. I have a two-part question, I guess.
Louis, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm sorry. I guess this is a two-part question. The first part is regarding the actual jury selection process. Could you elaborate a little bit on that, on the point at which one side elects, has a list of candidates, and the other side is either given an opportunity to either accept or reject the other side's list of candidates?
Louis, thanks. Peter Keene.
Well, it's not a question that one side has a list of candidates and the other side has. The jurors are drawn from the community at large, from voter registration rolls. So these are just citizens in the area that show up. I think what you're referring to in regard to the questionnaires that are given to the juries about their backgrounds, each side, both the prosecution and the defense, submit their proposed questions that they want answered to the prospective panelists. And then the judge puts together the ultimate questionnaire, which is a composite of the questions that the defense wanted and the prosecution wanted. And also the judge adds his own questions to that.
And then both the defense and the prosecution do get a certain number of sort of peremptory strikes, right? They can kick someone off, but they're limited in the number of people that they can boot.
Yeah, they're unlimited in terms of kicking people off who they actually show are biased. So they question the jury. And if they can bring out from the jurors some sort of bias that would interfere with the juror being a fair juror, then the judge has to throw that person off, and neither side has used the challenge. Then they have a number of peremptory challenges. They could just say, well, I just don't want this person, give no reason, and throw them off. Each side has an equal number for that.
Dominic in San Francisco has our next question. Dominic, go ahead. Dominic, are you with us?
Oh, yes.
Go ahead.
Why was there an answer ever given to why the officer wanted to?
Dominic, sorry, we're losing you. If you want to call back, I couldn't quite tell exactly what he was trying to get at, Peter Keene, but it sounded like he was asking something about whether or not he was going to be tased or not, and whether or not there was ever a legitimate reason for why Johannes Messerli would make that choice.
In terms of the evidence itself relating to why you would tase him, all of the evidence in regard to why he should be tased came from Messerli's own testimony, saying that in his opinion, he couldn't get the right arm out from under him, and he believed that he needed to handcuff him in order to subdue him, and that there might have been something under him that he was going to get at, perhaps some sort of weapon. But that's the totality of the evidence in regard to some sort of necessity to tase him. There was nothing else objectively that you could show either from the video or from any of the other witnesses where you could say, well, that shows that he needed to tase him.
And as you suggested before, part of what runs contrary to that is the fact that there was another officer there with his knee on Oscar Grant's head and pinning his arm down. But I guess, again, like so many other things with this trial, you can argue that either way, if he was, in fact, pinned down that way, then it's hard to understand why he would actually pull out a gun. The only thing that would make much sense is if it would be to use a taser, right? So you can kind of argue either of these things.
You can.
You can come to a conclusion either way.
You can. But the main problem that Messerli has, though, is that video clip showing at the moment he stands up and fires the gun that Grant's right arm is indeed subdued by the officer who's holding it down on Grant's back, and that contradicts Messerli's account that, no, the arm was underneath Grant.
To KC in San Leandro. KC, go ahead.
Yeah, to that last point, I would say that he should only use his taser in a case where he would be allowed to use his gun, and you can debate whether or not that was one of those cases. The other point I had mostly is that a lot of times in these cases you see the police being able to overlook his right to a trial. I mean, he hadn't done anything wrong, and that's part of the officer's job, is to be in danger, and he should always uphold his oath to the Constitution and to protect citizens. And even if that means his safety, I think that that's part of his job, and his safety is at risk then. And so maybe he does have to err on the side of he may get hurt, he may get shot, but that's just part of his job, and I see that as him being okay with that when he takes that job.
Casey, thanks. Thanks for the observation. One of the things that's been talked about, Peter Keene, in the trial is that police officers are trained, and I'm curious about your perspective on this, given your work on the San Francisco Police Commission, that they should only pull out a gun if they know what the consequences may be, that they should only pull out a gun if they think that lethal capacity is what's required.
Yeah. In fact, you can even put it more vividly than that, and that is that a police officer should only pull out a gun if a police officer believes he has to kill someone, because that's what a gun is meant for. That's the single thing that a gun is used for. You're going to pull out a gun, you're going to shoot it, you're going to kill someone. If something less than the need to kill someone is required, then the use of the gun is inappropriate.
Cass writes in from San Francisco, did the prosecution actually give the jurors the opportunity to hold a pistol and a taser in their hands and compare the differences and help discern the likelihood that the two could be confused? That still could happen in the jury room,
that
right?
That will happen. Yeah. That's set up. And in fact, one of the things that the prosecution did as final witness presented an expert, an investigator who said he had disarmed both the pistol and the taser. So, and both the pistol and the taser are going into the jury room. So the jurors will be able to hold the pistol, hold the taser in their hands and make determinations relating to the differences in weight and the way they feel.
Peter Keene from the Golden Gate University School of Law joining us this morning. We're also talking about the potential community reaction to that. If you have concerns about either how Oakland will fare during the aftermath of this trial or questions about the legalities of this case, you're welcome to join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum. So other emails coming in, Peter. This person writes, several articles have talked about the weight of Messerly's reaction immediately after the shooting. Even Oscar Grant's friend testified that Messerly looked to be in shock and said, oh, I shot him. How important will that reaction be to the jury's verdict?
I think that's a very important piece of evidence in Messerly's favor, that his own facial reaction, the facial reaction of immediate surprise and horror and the statement with an expletive about him shooting. That's inconsistent with the prosecution theory that he deliberately pulled out his gun, knowing he was pulling out his gun, meaning to shoot someone and shooting someone. That sort of instantaneous reaction on his part, that contradicts that. So that's one of, again, this difficult horse race that that juror is going to have to figure out in regard to how they're going to judge these very competing, conflicting pieces of evidence.
One of the things the jury also has to judge, and what has been so central over the course of the trial, is the video itself, all of that cell phone video that was taken that particular night. And I'm curious, as someone who thinks about these issues as a legal scholar, views the way in which trials are now changing, that cell phone and cell phone cameras are so ubiquitous that it gives juries a different task in a way. And I'm curious about whether or not we might be putting too much on that video evidence, that both sides sort of edited them together to try to give you a sense of what it was being seen from different points of view. But of course, this isn't like a baseball game where those cameras are live and a director is choosing from the camera on the third base side and then the camera on the first base side. This is all edited together to perhaps give different points of emphasis. So it makes things, in a way, more vivid for a jury. It gives you a different sense of what took place. But it also seems the possibilities to be misled by that are also there.
I think you raised two very important things, Dave. One is that ever since Rodney King, the whole aspect of having video evidence has changed the nature of so many trials. In the past, trials were people bringing their memory in and saying, well, I saw this, no, you didn't, and contradicting each other on the basis of memory. Now we have actually recorded recorded accounts of what occurred. However, with that comes the problem that you've also mentioned. The experts, in terms of the experts putting together these clips and putting together them using new forms of technology, there's some questionable aspects to that, because at some point in terms of putting the stuff together and editing it, you get into things almost to the point of morphing or the Zelig type effect of the Woody Allen movie and put something in into a particular type of video or put it in some way that it changes it and perhaps makes it inaccurate. So I think that the courts have to be very careful and very aware of that. Allow the videos, but I'm not so sure about allowing these experts to play with it and morph it and airbrush it and do all sorts of things that we seem to be heading in the direction of.
Well, and not to suggest that any of that was done in this particular case, but it sort of gives you the illusion of being there as an eyewitness when that isn't, I wonder, necessarily the case. We all know, even in a sporting event where you have the best quality cameras, that you can't always tell on instant mm-hmm. replay from a variety of angles what actually happened. Was he safe or was he out? So in this circumstance, with much less qualified both camera operators and cameras themselves, makes you wonder about how that will all play out. Scott Peterson has been joining us as part of this conversation, too. He is with the Oakland Chamber of Commerce, because part of what we also want to plumb as we pursue this topic is how the community will respond. I asked you previously, but I'd like to hear a bit more, Scott Peterson, about the role of the fund that you've created, the Oscar Grant Memorial Fund. What do you hope that that fund will create in the aftermath of all of this? Because as Tony Coleman was also suggesting, regardless of what the verdict is, we have to go forward from here. There have to be opportunities for young people. There have to be a way that we can achieve a peaceful progress within the city of Oakland. Tell me something, if you would please, about what you hope that fund will achieve.
Well, thanks for asking. The Oscar Grant Memorial Fund is set up by the business community to benefit youth organizations in the community that are working hard to create safe spaces for young people to learn and to enjoy Oakland and all it has to offer, but also to help young people fulfill their dreams and ambitions, because as we've heard following Oscar Grant's unfortunate death, that you know, he was trying to make a new life for himself, and he had you know, some trouble when he was younger, but he was trying to turn that around. And what we really want to make sure that everyone understands is that Oakland is a place for opportunity, and it is a place where people can fulfill their dreams and their ambitions, and you know, provide for their family, stabilize their neighborhood, and really invest in the community.
Stay with us for a moment more if you can, Scott Peterson, because we have a question coming in from Brian that you may be able to help us respond to. Brian, go ahead, please.
Yeah, a couple of things. I'd like to know what kind of preparation the Oakland PD and whatnot have done in terms of educating the public towards this point. There's a lot of detail to this that's probably not in the public sphere. And secondly, my son goes to daycare here at Oakland Parks and Rec, and I just minutes ago had to make sure that they have a game plan in place to get him out of the area. They're going to actually bus him out of the area if this thing, you know, were to go ugly. I'd like
Brian,
to know what kind
yep.
of...
Thanks. Thanks for the question. Chief Batts was on earlier talking about the preparations that the police department is making. Scott Peterson, maybe you can join in terms of some of the other preparations. I know if you want to know about BART schedules, for example, BART is putting out various announcements. You can go to their website or be texted on what the latest is with BART schedules if problems arise. What else can you tell us, Scott, about the sort of concerns that Brian is raising?
Well, it's a valid concern, and I have to point out that the Chief Batts and the mayor and the city staff have been very proactive in reaching out to community organizations in a variety of ways. You know, obviously, from what we've heard from Mr. Coleman earlier, they're working closely with the city and the police department to make sure that whatever rally occurs, you know, will be done in a peaceful way, and that any activity that's not peaceful will be contained. But the city also worked closely with the Chamber of Commerce and other merchant organizations to make sure that store owners in the downtown area and throughout the community are informed of, you know, what the preparations are. We all know that Oakland Police Department has mutual aid requests out to other police agencies from around the Bay Area. We know that the CHP is on alert as well. But, you know, we've also seen business owners that are, you know, they're taking precautions. I think many people are preparing for the worst, but hoping for the best. You're starting to see plywood go up on windows around the downtown in areas that were affected the last time we had, you know, demonstrations that started peacefully and then ended violently.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to see that, and we really want to remind people that this is the chance to show Oakland at its best and not at its worst. And we can't vilify anyone in this situation after the verdict. I mean, the actions are of one individual. They're not the actions of an entire police department. And we want to make sure that everyone's aware that there's places to go to.
Scott, sorry to interject, yourself. But we're almost out of time, and I'm going to have to hold you there. But thank you. Thanks for offering that and for leading the effort that you are on behalf of the city. Just have a moment left, Peter Keen. So kind of wrap up for us, if you would, what the jury now has to sort out. It sounds like you think the most likely outcomes are really between a second-degree murder choice or a voluntary manslaughter. Is that right? I mean, are those sort of the options that make the most sense to you?
Those are the most logical outcomes. But you got to remember what generally happens quite often in regard to juries is they don't do logical things. They're 12 people in there and they're horse trading, and sometimes they compromise. So even though it would appear that on basis of the evidence everyone was talked about, voluntary manslaughter, they shouldn't even be talking about it. They could, if they wanted to compromise between what the two sides are asking for them, one side saying second-degree murder, the other side saying an acquittal, the natural compromise might be voluntary manslaughter. But they're going to be in there, or it could be something that they could hang on it because it's a complicated case. Maybe they can't decide and it has to be done again.
We'll see what happens next. The defense is now wrapping up their arguments. The prosecution rebuttal is next, and then we'll see what the jury does. Peter Keen from the Golden Gate University School of Law. Thanks for being with us this morning, Peter.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, too, to both Scott Peterson and Tony Coleman and to Chief Anthony Batts for joining us to add their perspective on what will happen in Oakland next. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, and Tina Lorberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.